Today is Tuesday, February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, lawyers for the Trump administration will try to ask a court to overturn a stay on the implementation of the president's executive order prohibiting travel to the United States for many. But the U.S. president might face some problems.
President Trump does have a legacy of comments that are going to make it more difficult for him to defend this in court and in the public.
Also ahead, we'll speak with someone who explains the support for the president's executive order on travel, and you'll hear more about how seven particular Muslim countries were chosen to be the target of the presidential order. It's all on today's International Edition. A U.S. federal appeals court is due to hear oral arguments later today in the legal battle over President Trump's executive order suspending the country's refugee admissions program and banning entry to people from seven Muslim-majority nations. A brief filed by the Justice Department defends the ban as a lawful exercise of the president's authority over the entry of aliens into the U.S. and the admission of refugees. It calls a federal judge's order suspending that ban an error and vastly overboard. The states of Washington and Minnesota are the plaintiffs in this case. Court filings supporting them have come from attorneys general from 15 other states, the American Civil Liberties Union, and a group of nearly 100 companies. Well, a number of companies have submitted briefs in support of the ban. Two former secretaries of state, John Kerry and Madeleine Albright, say the executive order was ill-conceived, poorly implemented, and ill-explained. The case is likely to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. One analyst, New York-based attorney Dan McLaughlin, told VOA Persian's New Horizon program that the top U.S. court has a history of rulings that could be favorable to Trump's case if it gets that far. Mr. McLaughlin, who is the expert, also said that Trump's past advocacy of a U.S. ban on Muslim immigration when he was running for the presidency could come back to hurt him with the Supreme Court. Last Friday, U.S. District Court Judge James Robart of Washington State temporarily blocked Trump's executive order putting a hold on travel to the U.S. by all refugees, as well as travelers from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. After the judge's decision, the Customs and Border Protection Service started to allow travelers with valid visas to come to the United States. Joining us now is Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies for the Center for Immigration Studies based here in Washington, D.C. Jessica, thanks for being with us. What's your reaction so far to this seeming swell in public reaction to the Trump administration's travel ban?
Well, I think it's a bit of an overreaction. I think that the executive order to improve our vetting system is critically needed and should be allowed to go into effect for the sake of the integrity of our immigration programs and for the safety of the country. And I think that the judge's order that is now in place that has blocked the implementation of the order is unfortunate and not grounded in the law. It's going to be very interesting to see this play out, but this is really of enormous consequence, as I said, not only for our security, but also for the integrity of our visa program. We've had more than 580 people convicted of terror or terror-related offenses in the United States since 9/11, and about 380 of them were individuals who were not born in this country. About more than 60 of them were people who came from the seven countries that are covered by the pause in travel. So it's very clear that this is something that is long overdue and should be allowed to go into effect.
How do you answer those who say that of the people who have been vetted and have come here to the United States, that hardly any, if any, have been involved in any attacks?
Well, again, we know that a number of people from these countries have been convicted of terrorism-related crimes since 9/11, a large number of them, and that is why the Obama administration and Congress in 2015 moved to have these citizens of these seven countries subjected to additional screening. So it's already been recognized by both Congress and the previous administration that we needed to do a better job of screening people coming from these seven countries.
Let me focus on that just a second. And you obviously have heard statements by many refugee organizations saying that these banned countries are already and have been vetted very closely. The people involved, that some of them have been waiting for years to get refugee status.
Well, that's right. And obviously, I need to make clear that we all understand that most of the people coming from these countries are not a risk to Americans. But the problem is that we don't have a good enough way to make sure that we can find the ones who might be a risk to come to the country. After all, ISIS has been promising to infiltrate the flow of refugees and exploit our immigration system to send operatives to this country. They've already done it in Europe. The problem is that these seven countries are either state sponsors of terror or have governments in such a state of chaos that, you know, we cannot work with them to accomplish enough vetting. I was a consular officer working in embassies overseas, and I've tried to do this vetting before, and I don't think the average person realizes how difficult it is and how important it is to have a relationship with the government and to have people on the ground somewhere in order to have an adequate vetting system. That's not the case, for example, in Syria, Yemen, Somalia. Iran is a state sponsor of terror, and we've had a number of problems with terrorists from Iran, the most recent being an attempted assassination attempt of a Saudi ambassador in the United States. So, you know, the length of time that people are waiting to get their visa approved does not necessarily mean that they are thoroughly vetted. It just means that our government agencies are so overwhelmed with the number of applications and the difficulty of vetting that it takes that long to accomplish it.
Let me just ask you about these upcoming court proceedings. As you know, one of the main thrusts of the argument against the ban is that it is religiously targeted. We know that the executive order did not mention Muslims at all, but nevertheless, I believe, and I think we all believe, that those against the ban will bring up some ancillary statements made by both the president and Rudy Giuliani that it was indeed aimed at a Muslim target. How do you react to that?
Of course, these seven countries are majority Muslim, but there are many, you know, more populous, bigger countries that are majority Muslim that are not subject to this pause in admissions. And so I think it's clear that it is not motivated by animus toward a particular religion, but, you know, toward the need to do a better job of screening people who are coming from seven countries that are of particular concern because of their sponsorship of terrorism or because of the chaotic nature and the fact that there are terrorist groups operating in those countries. So this is not about a religion. This is about making sure that people who threaten the United States are going to have a harder time getting in.
Jessica Vaughn is the Director of Policy Studies for the Center of Immigration Studies here in Washington. Jessica, thanks so much for your time and information.
You're very welcome.
Now, while the courts consider the issue of the White House plan, questions still linger about the choice of the countries named in the order. VOA's Mel Arcega has more on that.
With the Trump administration's controversial immigration order facing growing opposition, two key questions remain. How did the seven Muslim countries make the list of those designated for travel restrictions? And why were other Muslim countries historically associated with terrorism left out? The White House says it relied on a list handed down by the previous administration.
What it is to make sure that the people who are coming in are vetted properly from seven countries that were identified by the Obama administration.
The so-called countries of concern list had its origins in this little-known law, the Visa Waiver Program Improvement and Terrorist Travel Prevention Act of 2015. The law sought to prevent so-called foreign fighters holding European passports who had traveled to the battlefields of Iraq, Syria, and other countries of concern from taking advantage of visa-free travel to the U.S. The Department of Homeland Security later added Iran, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, and Yemen to that list. In arguing for travel restrictions, the executive order says numerous foreign-born individuals have been associated with terrorism in the United States since the attacks of September 11, 2001. But if the order's goal is protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry, the administration may have picked the wrong countries, says Charles Kurzman of the University of North Carolina. We spoke to him via Skype.
It turns out that there have been zero fatalities in the United States caused by extremists from these seven countries.
Kurzman's research on Muslim involvement in violent extremism in the United States shows that attacks carried out by Muslim American extremists have caused 123 deaths since the 9/11 attacks.
The level of involvement in violent extremism by Muslims in the United States is still quite low, as compared with the overall number of murders and violence in the United States.
Adnan Kifayat, an expert on countering violent extremism, has another explanation. The seven countries are easy targets.
It's not as if Somalia or the central government of Somalia can really effectively mount a challenge to the United States politically, or for that matter, Libya, which really does not have a centrally functioning government, or Syria, which is mired in civil war.
Kifayat says the Trump administration is likely to expand the list. But with the immigration order facing legal challenge in U.S. courts, its future remains uncertain. I'm Millar Sega from Masood Farivar, VOA News, Washington.
This is International Edition from VOA. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, and joining us is VOA's Doug Bernard, who was scanning all social media throughout the day.
I just have it implanted in my brain now.
Well, I didn't want to tell you how it looked, you know, but it's there. But nevertheless, the name Rosie O'Donnell is cropping up.
This seems like one of the most unlikely stories or items to be trending. Rosie O'Donnell, something I guess sort of B or C level, you know, talk show host or actress or whatnot, really not talking about a lot these days. Here's the background of the story and why she's trending so strongly. Over this weekend, Saturday Night Live, which is a satiric program that airs weekly, had a little skit parroting Sean Spicer, the president's press secretary. A lot of people thought it was very funny. Sean Spicer did not, but apparently we're learning through reporting by Politico and the New York Times, apparently the president, President Trump, was really unhappy about that. One Trump donor told Politico, quote, "Trump doesn't like his people to look weak." And the Politico and the New York Times reporting says that more than just sort of being lampooned or made fun of, really the problem in the president's eyes was that Sean Spicer was being parodied by a woman.
Oh, no.
So this has created some issues. Anyway, long story short, what that has led to is a online social media campaign to have Rosie O'Donnell, who famously had a long-standing feud with President Trump, to play Steve Bannon, perhaps in the coming weeks, on this satiric television program. I'm just going to go through some of the many, many, many tweets. She hasn't trended like this in a decade, at least. I'm guaranteeing
she's
you that.
Smiling today, yeah.
She's smiling today. Let's see. Rosie O'Donnell ready to play Steve Bannon on SNL. Can't wait. Trump is going to be so furious. Let's see. Here's one. It's way too early for Santa Claus, but number one on my list is Rosie at Rosie O'Donnell to play Steve Bannon. I liked this one. Someone's coming up with a whole complete cast here. Sin tweets out, new SNL cabinet. Meryl Streep to play Donald Trump. Rosie O'Donnell to play Steve Bannon. Melissa McCarthy to play Sean Spicer, as she did before. And Ellen DeGeneres to play Vice President Mike Pence. I don't know which of those would create more frustration. Anyway, it's in the weird way that social media works. That's what people are kind of latching onto at the moment, and so there it is for a day.
I couldn't have made this up.
No,
we can't do that.
No, don't ask me to explain it. I just report.
Well, you've been sitting here shaking your head.
Yes.
That's about it. Doug Bernard here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the world now, a U.S. federal appeals court is due to hear oral arguments in the legal battle over President Trump's executive order suspending the country's refugee admissions program and banning entry to people from seven Muslim-majority nations. Afghan officials say a suicide bomb attack near the Supreme Court building in the capital of Kabul has killed at least 20 people and wounded about 40 others. Human rights groups, a number of U.S. lawmakers, and several retired generals and former ambassadors say they're concerned about President Trump's defense of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The rights group Amnesty International says the Syrian government has executed thousands of prisoners and buried their bodies in mass graves in what amounts to war crimes. The Palestinian Authority reacts angrily to a new Israeli law retroactively legalizing about 100 settlement outposts in the occupied territories. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers find that a supermassive black hole took about a decade to feast on the remains of a star it had ripped apart. This astronomical incident, called a tidal disruption event, or TDE, takes place when a star or other object wanders too close to a black hole's event horizon, the point where its gravitational pull becomes so intense that nothing, even light, can escape it. The astronomers say the TDE they discovered lasted more than 10 times as long than any other observation of a star's death by black hole. The astronomical team thinks the star consumed by the giant black hole had to be either the most massive star to be ripped to shreds by a TDE, or was the first observation of the most complete obliteration of a smaller star. To make their findings, the researchers used a trio of X-ray space telescopes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA.
VOAAfrica.com. If you want to learn more about the news stories that change the world, we invite you to visit our webpage, VOAAfrica.com. To find the latest news, look in the upper right-hand corner of the page. You can read the news updates around the clock. VOA Africa, on the air, online, mobile.
Just imagine if you could hook up your brain to a computer. What are the possibilities that could unlock? Science fiction has explored this idea in many films, including an upcoming movie called Mind Gamers. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
I give you Enoch, a quantum connection.
The film Mind Gamers is set in a world where students create a wireless neural network that can link people's minds through a quantum computer. It allows people to transfer motor skills from one brain to another, but also opens the door for mass mind control. In the real world, research towards brain-computer interface is underway.
The most fundamental good is restoration of function for people who have limited capabilities. If it's, let's say, a paraplegic who can't move, allowing them to walk again.
Tim Mullen says his company, Cusp Neural Technologies, is working to create a cloud-based platform to digitally link a person to the cloud, and from there, to any internet-connected device, such as this multiplayer brain-controlled game. Mullen says a type of mediated telepathy, or brain-to-brain communication, may also be in the horizon.
Currently, we can do this in rats, sensory motor cortices. First experiments in humans have been demonstrated in a very limited way, and that in the coming decades, we'll actually be able to have brain-to-brain communication between humans.
Writer and producer of Mind Gamers, Joanne Ray, sees the benefits of connecting brains to the cloud as a mass collective that changes human behavior.
The need of the ego to put oneself first is redundant in our society. And that would be a benefit if that could just fall away like a monkey tail.
This rosy picture, yes, we can get there, but in doing so, we will enable this whole other dark side. And we need to plan for it, and we need to have some mitigating strategies for it.
University of Southern California's Todd Richman works with emerging disruptive technologies. He warns internet hacking and other criminal behaviors will be magnified as scientists pursue certain types of innovation.
Part of the challenge is that a lot of the innovation right now is driven by the commercial sector. And in that case, their focus is on profitability and getting a new product out there, getting a new capability, the new shiny object that they want to excite the consumer to buy. So for them, moral and ethical repercussions are not necessarily part of their development process.
Science is a process of being on the edge. You don't know what the outcome is going to be of the technology you're building. You don't know how it will be used. The responsibility lies on society to use that technology for good.
We aren't perfect, and we will make mistakes. And the people who are designing the tech have to have the right mindset, or they could take us in a direction we don't want to go.
Spark it up.
Through Mind Gamers, filmmakers present one possible direction this technology can go. Scientists will soon be able to tell how audiences respond when 1,000 people watch the film wearing cognition headbands. This mass mind state experiment will be possible with the help of cloud technology.
I will connect you all. Do not fear it.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
One.
We figured you want to hear that. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Ira Mellon in Washington. Have a good day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is working closely with Nigeria to improve efficiencies in the vital oil sector. The U.S. Commercial Service Nigeria sponsored a single company promotion event in Lagos on January 26th that focused on strengthening the skills of process operators working in Nigeria's refinery and chemical industry, said United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, Mission Director Michelle Godet. The event launched a new training simulation solution by New Jersey-based Simulation Solutions Incorporated. Simulation Solutions is a leading provider of PC-based dynamic simulation training programs for process operators in the refinery and chemical industries, as well as for government and academia. The company's INSTO five-step process technology operator training for professionals has been used by downstream oil firms all over the world to improve plant efficiency. U.S. Consul General John Bray said in his opening remarks that for Nigeria to overcome its current economic challenges, it must find ways to diversify its economy while improving firm-level productivity. He encouraged participants to actively engage with simulation solutions to improve their organization's bottom-line profitability. Over 60 representatives from across Nigeria's petrochemical sector, including officers from Nigeria's National Oil Company, regulatory agencies, as well as professionals drawn from private refineries, training institutes, and academia, learned how companies can effectively operate their plants without accidents and downtime, saving costs and improving profitability. U.S. Commercial Service Counselor Brent Omdahl anchored the event. Audience participants expressed keen interest in establishing a partnership with Simulation Solutions and in adapting the simulator training program to their individual operations. Academic speakers encouraged a gradual introduction of the training program into technical and executive skills curricula. In the coming months, the U.S. Commercial Service in Nigeria will continue to support Simulation Solutions and its Nigeria partners as they roll out training programs at interested organizations across the country. The United States is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to promote trade that benefits the U.S., Nigeria, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.